For thousands of years, within thousands of species, males have gone out of their way to chase the proverbial skirts of females. Through such intricate behavior as wearing black socks in bed, leaving the toilet seat up, and 100,000 other cliches maintained by 100,000,000,000,000,000 generalizations, it has been suggested that the male continues to enjoy a strange societal advantage over his female counterpart. And who is any man really to disagree? Ah, but science, while not being able to account for the stunning financial success of many superhero movies this summer, seems to suggest otherwise. Okay, so I am here with Faye Flam, who is the author of The Score. Faye, how are you doing today?
I'm fine. How are you, Ed?
I'm fantastic, and we have coffee on the way. But I wanted to ask a sort of general question first and foremost. I mean, why did you decide upon Future and this boot seduction camp as the prism with which to bring the reader into this notion of gender versus evolutionary science, or in relation to evolutionary science, because it seems as if you kind of set up this construct with which to be knocked down. So why did you feel that this was the best one to approach this issue?
Well, what happened was I was going to do an evolutionary history of the male sex, you know, from the beginning. And the beginning was 600 million years ago in the sort of microbial primordial soup, when some organisms, there was a little trick, and some of them started making sex cells that were smaller than the other sex, and they were the first sperm, and those were the first males. And it was actually really interesting. I interviewed a lot of microbiologists who study early life about the origin of the sexes and how that played out. And there was something about the cellular structures called the mitochondria, which are only passed down through one sex or the other. And that actually has big implications for sex differences throughout the whole tree of life.
Yeah.
So I'm really getting into this, but then I'm thinking, I can't start my book here because I'll scare away everybody except for the most hardcore science nerds.
I mean, oh, I don't know.
As sort of a science writer, we usually try to bring in something familiar or human to sort of help ease people into the more heavy-duty genetics or microbiology or whatever we're writing about. And so I was thinking, okay, well, how am I going to start this book? I shouldn't start it with these microbes. I don't want to start with the microbes. And a publicist had sent me a book called The Mystery Method, How to Get Beautiful Women into Bed.
Yeah.
And it was just sitting there on my desk, you know, and I was thinking, I was just procrastinating. I picked it up and started looking at it.
Yeah.
And I kept looking. It was actually kind of an interesting book. And I thought, you know, maybe this is where I should start. And I could connect sort of where humans are now and what kinds of crazy things we do with these events that happened millions of years ago.
But not every man, Faye, is going to sit down and slap thousands of dollars wanting to get laid like this.
No.
I mean, this isn't the archetypal man. I mean, it's almost as if it's an extraordinary, almost cartoonish-like construct with which to respond with science and with examples and with other species and the like. So, I mean, I'm wondering why this was the one. Why you couldn't just have some sort of, I guess, schlumpy guy in a bar who isn't paying thousands of dollars for this.
I guess so. But, I mean, these classes are pretty popular.
Yeah.
There are a lot of guys who are into this, and the game was a best-selling book, so it was a pretty big phenomenon.
Yeah.
And it was a little extraordinary, which was what made it interesting. I wanted to start with something that was human and yet not totally mundane. And
and
it caught my interest. And it did reflect, I think, this idea of the male sex sort of working at just getting sex. You know, women will put a lot of effort into our hair and our makeup, but not really to get sex. I mean, you could walk into a bar without any makeup and still get some guy to go home with you. We have a
depends on what type of bars you frequent.
We have a more. I think we have the fact that these guys were willing to go so far out on a limb. It seemed like an extreme version of something that I thought was fairly familiar. Guys that would put out a lot of effort just to get sex, to get laid, to get a one night stand. That, to me, this was one of these sort of fundamental sex differences that I think we've all observed. That
you need to fight fire or fight the rules with real rules then, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I really kind of use them just to illustrate a point and a principle and bring human beings into this sort of scientific story. And to show that this was, even though I was writing about all kinds of life forms, that in the end I was writing about them to help us understand ourselves, that humans were at the center of this story, even though I range over plants, animals, fungus, you know, everything. Male, well, everything.
To get to some of the nitty-gritty in this, I mean, you bring up the SRY gene, which, of course, is problematic. There was some controversy a few years ago when they were using it for the Olympics to determine gender verification, as I'm sure you're aware of.
Yeah.
But you point to a number of, like, differentiating aspects of what we commonly accept to be the gene that determines masculinity. You point to this Italian village where there are those who don't have the SRY
right.
gene and who are double X and who are masculine. And you also point to the female South American bull mice who have the SRY gene but are not in fact male. So I'm wondering though how species and this particular isolated example, what this says about gender difference. I mean, are you bringing up the SRY gene to show that, well, the delineation between gender that we commonly accept should not necessarily be accepted, that we need to have a more fluid form using evolutionary science for what gender is?
Well, to me, it just showed that the world is so much more interesting when you take a closer look at it. As soon as you start to examine something scientifically, it turns out it's just much more complex, and also that living things are more connected than we thought, that different species have different ways of determining who's a male and who's a female, and that there are connections between all of them. So that this sort of extraordinary case where these men didn't have an SRY gene, there was another gene that's important for determining sex in other animals and is apparently very important in us too. And that gene was somehow turned on when it should have been turned. I can't remember whether it was on when it should have been off or off, but it was sort of downstream of
yeah.
SRY. So it shows that there are actually a lot of genes in the human genome that are important for determining sex. SRY is sort of a powerful one, and so almost all males have an SRY, almost all females don't. But
yes.
because there are other ones that are at play, you can have some unusual situations. So
yeah.
I don't know if it's that we need to change our way of thinking, but just that once you start to look at it, it's a more interesting story than anyone could have imagined. And to me, it's interesting just to see how we inherited these things and how we came from other life forms that had a completely different sex-determining mechanism, and they can change. You know, that people talk about the Y chromosome
yeah.
disappearing, and if that does happen, it's happened in a couple of other animals, something else will take over, that you'll still have males. We don't know what, but
yeah.
You can have a sex chromosome that then becomes defunct, and another chromosome will be turned into a sex chromosome.
Yes.
So I just find all this really...
There's a backup gene, basically,
yeah.
for masculinity. But, I mean, this issue of delineation between gender, I mean, this pretty much says to everyone that it's not so cut and dry. It's not entirely SRY.
That's true. It's not. I mean, most people are clearly male or female, but there are a lot of cases where people have unusual combinations of chromosomes, and it's not so clear. There are people that, right, there are XY women, and there are XX men, and some of them you wouldn't know. I mean, you would never know they had, and they don't know until they have problems with fertility. But then there are other cases where people have I don't know if you read that wonderful book, Middlesex, but that's actually
yeah,
based on a real genetic disorder in which you have male genetics, but there's something, one of the genes you need to release testosterone doesn't work. And
yeah.
so testosterone, it comes out in adolescence, but not at the beginning. So you look like a girl when you're born, but then when you turn 13 or so, you start to look like a boy. So
yeah.
so there are all kinds of things that can happen. It's not so much that we're all somewhere in between male and female, but that there is such a complicated set of things that happens that make us what we are, and any little anomaly or variation can put people somewhere in the middle. So it's also, there are people that are somewhere in that range for different reasons.
But to bring up the vole mice, and actually more specifically the bonobo and the chimpanzees, which you bring up, the bonobo, I mean, it may be closely related to us, but as you point out in this book, they're more openly bisexual. And as you also point out in this book, current research into bisexuality is sparse and subject to how you define bisexual. So you have here the bonobo, which cedes also more of their power to the females, and how does looking at another species or another ape who is even closer to us really determine who we are. I mean, where are the correlations here exactly?
Well, people often ask, are humans monogamous? Are we by nature monogamous, or are we by nature polygamous? Are we by nature more like certain monkeys that have a pair bond and the father brings up the babies? Or are we by nature more like dogs or chimps that just mate randomly and the males don't really do any parenting? And is it just culture that sort of forces people into these roles? So I think it's a very central question to our identity. And I think the only way to answer it is to look at ourselves in the context of the natural world and try to get a handle on that. Because some animals are very monogamous by nature without any push from culture. And we do seem to have some connection to those. I think there is some biological pair bonding in people and biological paternal instinct, I think, on the part of men that men have just cross-culturally do take an interest in their children and try to help with their children. So we're not somehow hardwired to be like dogs or chimps that the fathers don't do anything, but we don't quite seem to be as hardwired to be monogamous and parental as, say, emperor penguins either.
Yeah.
So we're kind of an interesting species in that we may be in transition from a more chimp-like species to a more penguin-like species.
Yeah.
We might be just somewhere, we seem to be kind of in between, and I think it can be very helpful in trying to understand nature and culture and who we are, to look at, and it helps to know which species are most closely related to us, though our behavior still seems to somehow reflect behavior of species that are not so closely related. That most monogamous animals, they're monogamous birds, many monogamous birds, but mammals, by and large, don't. There are some that have pair bonding and parental care, but many don't.
There are two issues in this book that actually reflect this very idea of, well, are we evolutionarily wise hardwired to fall within a natural reproductive pattern? I'll start by bringing up the Alan Alda mass testosterone poisoning, the infamous article that he wrote in 1975. This is intriguing to me because you pointed out that this set off a trend in which testosterone was considered bad. But I should also point out, I'm not sure if you saw it, but there was a recent Associated Press article that indicated that in France, macho men are now on the wane, that there is this interesting cultural reappropriation of what it is to be macho or to have testosterone, and even the most macho French actor cannot, in fact, look and dress like a macho man. So it brings to mind a certain kind of culture versus evolution argument, but at the same time, it also has me wondering whether it's maybe not so bad for Alan Alda to question the notion of testosterone. Maybe it's just a matter of humans trying to understand exactly how testosterone works. We think that we are civilized, that we have control over our natural feral impulses, and yet we are kind of in this discussion pattern over the last 30 years over what this really is. I mean, I'm wondering if you're being entirely fair to Alda and his followers, because it could just very well be a rather exaggerated term like poisoning with which to actually understand what is inherently natural and what can be controllable.
Well, I never really thought of Frenchmen as being macho. It's probably a whole different brand of macho than Americans have. A whole sort of French style, I guess. I found that men in France to be very friendly and outgoing, but not macho by, I guess, American definitions. I mean, one thing I think I brought up Alan Alda, and maybe I made fun of him a little bit, but I think he brought up a very interesting point, which is that we use this term hardwired, but it's not a very good term. A lot of scientists really dislike it because it implies that we are we're robotic, that we're programmed to be a certain way. And the testosterone issue is interesting because it shows that men, like women, are subject to hormones, that hormones are, they do to men what hormones do to women. We tend to think, oh, women, they're driven by the hormones. But men are not only driven by their ebb and flows of testosterone, but by other hormones like oxytocin. So I think it helps us look at male behavior in a little different way, that men, like women, are driven by hormones, and hormones change. So you actually have more testosterone in certain points of your life than others. You have more at certain times of the day than others.
Yeah.
That events in your life can change that. So it shows that men are more complicated and more fluid and not hardwired. And so I think that in a way, you can think of it as good or bad, like anything, and having too much of anything is bad. Yeah. Having, obviously, it's not poison, but and men who have too little testosterone can have problems with depression and things. So you do, you kind of want some, and women have some too.
It's
an essential thing. Well, poisoning, it's kind of a funny term.
But it's interesting that you bring up, I mean, it seems to me that evolution versus culture seems to be the linchpin here, because you bring up not only Alan Alda, which is a piece of, I suppose, it could be construed as stunt journalism, but also Andrew Sullivan's little experiment when he injected himself with testosterone.
Right.
So the sense I'm getting here is that, well, these may be rather extraordinary ways with which to grasp the testosterone issue and to kind of understand it. So I'm wondering, is this an effort by journalism to wrestle with this larger notion of what it is to have testosterone as a hormone?
I think it is. I think, and we seem that the pendulum kind of swings from it's bad and masculinity is something that's sort of out of control and can cause problems to it's good and we should have the more of it the better. And Andrew Sullivan says when he injects it, it just makes him daring and makes him, you know, all these wonderful things. And I think, wow, like, so does that mean women can't be those things? So he goes in the other direction, you know, that it's all good and the more the better. And Alan Alda calls it poison. So, you know, the reality is somewhere.
The right suggestion I'm making here, though, is that they're both tackling the same issue
they
from
are.
Two different sides, and we don't actually have this middle ground that is more predicated upon evolution or scientific theory and the like. I'm wondering if this is the... We have a problem, perhaps, here in perception. You know?
Maybe. Scientists who study it, I think, that especially ones who are in the medical field, are in the middle ground. They understand that you want a certain amount, that having too little is bad, having too much is bad.
Mm-hmm.
People who inject it tend to end up in trouble in different ways.
Yeah.
Usually nature gives you the amount you should have. And they are taking a sort of a more sensible middle ground approach. I think I wrote about one group of researchers who were looking at the connections between low and high testosterone and health problems. And so if you actually go to the research labs where they're doing really useful research, they are in the middle. But it does show a struggle that people are still having in our culture, trying to figure out what to make of the sex differences that we see out there and the variation, the different kinds of men, that men are not all the same, that some men are more Alan Alda-like and some are, you know, more macho, more like Arnold Schwarzenegger. So and which kind do we like better? You know, what kind should we celebrate?
But to bring this back to the whole mystery method debate that we were talking about at the onset of this conversation, I mean, this is extraordinary to me because this comes from the same impulse of using a rather over-the-top model or perception to understand a larger problem. I mean, I'm trying to sort of figure out whether this book is really kind of a way to essentially deflate some of these rather exaggerated notions.
A little bit, yes, and I try to do that. I mean, it is a little bit, and I do, when I meet Mystery himself and I describe him, you know, he is sort of not your typical guy, not what I expected to meet. I didn't really know what I would find there. Some of what they do, it's kind of comical. I mean, it's kind of cute in a way. You know, they're not that different from, some of them are not that different from just any guy who's trying to, they're single and kind of doesn't want a long-term relationship at the time. And is looking around.
Yeah.
It's sort of interesting that these guys kind of band together. None of their techniques are really extraordinary. A lot of them are just basic self-improvement and things that women try to do that it's almost like a way for men to get around, sit around and almost act like women, you know. How do we act, you know, worrying about behavior, talking about women and, you know, having little focus groups together.
Yeah.
And then they have to act macho so that it doesn't seem like they're acting like a bunch of girls.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, at the same time, it does represent a good faith effort, I suppose, to understand. I mean, all these men are essentially in this seduction club to get laid in a rather remarkable way. You know, there's the one guy who is there who has slept with hundreds of women and doesn't want any kind of error. He wants to eliminate any kind of margin of error by taking this particular class. And so I'm wondering, though, if this is really, this particular sliver in this club really is a fair way to draw larger conclusions about evolution and about what is hardwired or to use a better term, innate.
Right. Well, and what was interesting to me after, because I didn't really know whether I would use this class for the book or not, I just, when they said I could go and sit in, I thought, well, that I was so curious. What am I going to learn? And I listened to them. And what was interesting was that the men in this class were all different. Some of them said, you know, I really just want to meet the right girl and get married, but I'm shy and I just don't do that well dating. And I want to be able to meet more women. I don't meet that many. So I found that even in that class, it ranged from the guy who said he'd slept with 200 women and wanted more to a couple of guys that just said, you know, I don't know why, I'm shy. I feel like I'm successful in my business life and successful in my financial life, but my love life is terrible and I don't necessarily want to get laid. I just want to meet a great woman and settle down and have kids. And so it was interesting that that class actually sort of showed the whole gamut of, you know, kind of a great variety. It broke the stereotypes. There were all types there.
I see. Well, I mean, to approach this scenario from a slightly different vantage point, I wanted to bring up a study that was uncovered by New York Times reporter John Tierney that you bring out that pointed out that a shorter man must earn more money to attract the same number of dates as a taller man of less income. And that the pickup class you attended likewise urged shorter men to do this. But the study that Tierney cited actually comes from Gunter Hitch and Ale Hortaksu. And they only questioned online daters. And so this was not mentioned in the book. And I'm wondering if, because the territory of, say, Match.com is based and predicated upon filling in variables, whether this is a proper conclusion to draw about short and taller men. In fact, even Tierney pointed out that online daters find minute faults in hundreds of potential partners, and so I'm wondering if this is really a fair correlation here.
Well, it might not be. I mean, I was sort of having a little fun with that because these guys wear these platform shoes, you know, and I love short men. So I personally, when I read that, I thought, well, they obviously didn't talk to me because I've had many boyfriends who are 5'6", 5'7", 5'8". That's perfectly good height for me, and I don't care whether they make more money than a taller guy. So it is possible, you know, anytime you study human behavior, it's tricky because you have different, some people study speed dating, some people study online dating, and it is very hard to get a true reflection of what people are thinking because humans are so unpredictable, and it's hard to get a big enough sample size. So if I have another edition, I'll put a footnote in there that was online dating.
Yeah.
Because I think you can get a lot of information about people from online dating, but they probably aren't a perfect sample.
You certainly can, but it doesn't account for, say, face-to-face contact,
yeah,
or the ability to, you know, pick up someone in the bar that we were alluding to rather bodily earlier on.
I mean,
is it really possible, even Kinsey, who put in a lot of work trying to get a large sample, couldn't quite draw absolute conclusions about sexuality, although he certainly opened up the floodgates to point out that, well, this whole heterodoxy that we celebrate in our human behavior isn't so, is not so much. And so I'm wondering then, to probe into this kind of thing, I mean, whether there really are, whether we're no better off than, say, we were like 1,000, 2,000 years ago in trying to figure out this problem.
Well, we can't. Human behavior is probably harder to understand than, you know, the inner workings of the atom or the Big Bang theory. I mean, human behavior is hard for science to get a good grip on it, and social science doesn't tend to be as precise and as easily testable and measurable as the physical sciences and the biological sciences. And I think it's sort of understood, but I don't think that means that it's not a worthy cause to try to use science to get a handle on it. As long as we understand the imprecise nature of it, we understand the margin of error, we understand that there is a huge variation out there. And something I try to get across in the book, because I get annoyed when people talk about sex differences and they say, men are more this, women are more that, women are this, men are that. It annoys me because a lot of times these differences are just differences in the average, and they're fairly subtle, and you can't make predictions about any given individual from this. You can learn about sort of where we come from and why we are the way we are, but you can't just look at somebody and say, okay, that person has a Y chromosome, so I can draw all these conclusions about that individual person. So humans are just so much more complex and interesting than that,
but
including men.
You also bring up the finger length scenario. You cite Joan Roughgarten's book, Evolution's Rainbow, which observes that male white-throated sparrows evolved into different types. You have the white-striped sparrows for the ones who have more testosterone, and the tan stripes for those who were more nurturing and more feminine males. And then you also bring up the idea of the relative length between the ring and the index fingers in humans, and how this can sometimes be used to tell the difference in terms of testosterone levels, and yet, I looked into this one too. Dr. Peter Hurd of the University of Alberta noted that this only amounted to about 5% of those personality differences. And so I'm wondering if it's really a matter of possibly brain chemistry or neurological development that creates these physical differences. Is this a starting point? I mean, you know, we get into a real complicated situation. I mean, if 5%, I mean, that may be helpful, better than 0%, but nevertheless, right, that's such a small sample of which to make a sweeping kind of distinction between gender.
I mean, I think what that type of research brings out that is interesting is that there is this factor it's not genetic, it's a biological factor that can influence our behavior and physiology, but it's not genetic, and that has to do with what goes on in the womb when your mother was pregnant with you, that can have an influence on your behavior and your physiology. And I think that those studies just show that this exposure to testosterone in the womb can have a small effect on you. So it was more just pointing out yet another thing that can influence us, and that is related to gender. And the finger length stuff is very controversial. It's very subtle.
Yeah.
But there is something, there is a small correlation between exposure to testosterone in utero and finger length. And then there are some small correlations between that exposure and some other traits.
Yeah.
Especially in women, things like fertility are very subtly correlated with that. So it's just interesting in it, that it points out something we don't think of. We tend to think of biological equals genetic. So
subtly correlated, how so?
In that if you study large groups of people, that you can connect women who are more fertile or have more children are the ones that have a longer index finger. And it's correlated in a way that's subtle. It's not like, well, if you have a longer ring finger, you're going to be infertile.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a correlation that's statistically significant, but not so big that you can draw any conclusions about an individual person from looking at that. It's something where you can look at averages and see that there's something going on, a kind of common thing with this side.
But humans are not sparrows.
No, but we're influenced in ways that, I mean, you can have something that is significant across a large group, but it won't be significant enough to make predictions about any one individual.
Yeah.
And I think that's why, right, the sparrows, you can probably make a pretty good prediction if the tan ones were the more masculine ones, or the white ones were the more masculine ones, the tan ones were the more feminine ones. So you could look at the coloration, and there seemed to be some kind of a switch that you were either one or the other and not in between. And so you could make some predictions. Humans don't quite work like that, but I just thought that it was very interesting that hormones, again, play more of a role than has been appreciated.
Yeah.
And that there is more variation within the female gender, within the male gender, that all men are not created equal, all women are not created equal. So it's just another interesting factor that said something about us as humans, but you wouldn't want to draw, you couldn't look at someone's hand and say, oh, okay, now I know everything.
I've been seeing you eye my hand.
People did when I was at the meeting where they talked about that. We all looked at our hands and we're like, oh my God, what? I was looking at mine. I still can't figure it. You have to hold your hand. If you hold your hand a certain way, it can make it look like you're.
Yeah.
So I have yet to figure out whether my index finger is actually the proper length.
Well, look, there is something to be said. For example, Rachmaninoff had large hands. And because of this is why he became such a virtuoso pianist and composer. I think that perhaps there are some evolutionary factors that cause certain people to, I guess, rise above or perhaps shift into certain stations in life. But I mean, I think maybe what we're talking about here is, because human beings are so complex and there is no foolproof answer, that maybe it's a matter of looking and applying evolutionary science on a kind of minute level, like Rachmaninoff, for example.
What was the question there again?
Well, it's sort of, I suppose I'm asking whether evolutionary questions along these lines that are applied to sparrows perhaps are better applied in humans when we look at a smaller sector or a smaller physical feature that perhaps, you know, something that leads Rachmaninoff to become a composer and the like?
I don't know. I think people are animals, and we can be understood in similar ways. I mean, we have testosterone is the same hormone that makes those birds look different. So
yeah,
we're subject to a lot of the same biological forces. They are at work in us, and I think looking at the way they play out in other animals can help us understand how they might work in us. We'll never be as simple and understandable as other animals, but
yeah,
it can give
that
us
wouldn't
an
be
idea.
Fun, would it?
It wouldn't be any fun. It wouldn't be any fun. No, and we have culture. Culture is such a powerful factor, but I think culture and biology can sometimes influence each other.
Yeah.
That things that say that sort of when people do cross-cultural studies about whether men are possessive of women, whether women are condemned for being sexual and for having multiple partners, that
yeah,
there does seem to be some sort of universal. Very few countries have men that say, "Oh yeah, I don't care, you know, if my wife sleeps around." There are a few, but possessiveness is a trait that you see in other animals.
Yeah.
Possessiveness of females, and so maybe understanding that can help us deal with it, because horrible things happen in this world because of laws, and you know, there are honor killings, all kinds of terrible things,
yeah,
where women are sort of held prisoner because of this possessiveness.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Why, to bring up a similar issue, I wanted to ask you about the question you raise. You write, "In a world where evolution favors traits that advance reproduction, how could homosexuality continue to flourish? But while you present a number of examples in other species, I'm not certain if you entirely answer the question yet." I'm not sure if you saw this. There was a study last week that posed this sexually antagonistic selection theory, a bit like the prisoner's dilemma, but it suggested that a gene that can be reproductively harmful to one sex can also be harmful to another. And I'm wondering if you believe in this, or that homosexuality is in some sense vital to human beings, which is why it has lasted so much, that there is some... I mean, do you have a kind of correlation to many of the examples that you bring here, that it's just a sort of evolutionary advantageous variable that is part of the human equation?
Well, it's an interesting question, and I think that the science continues to advance on that, which is why I wanted to address it in the book. As people continue to look at it, it's an unanswered question.
Yeah.
Though we are, I think most scientists would argue that there's something biological. It's not a so-called choice, but it's there's something biological going on. Why it happens? There are many possibilities. So it's not while scientists haven't answered the question, it's not a complete stumper. There are many ways that it could happen. I mean, if there were a number of different genes that were all advantageous, except in a certain combination, they lead to homosexuality, that could explain it. It's also many gay people have children,
yes,
and have had over time, and so unless they were completely repulsed by the opposite sex to where they couldn't reproduce, whatever genetic component probably does get passed on.
But I'm wondering if, because it has been throughout the history of humanity,
right,
I mean, maybe it's something that is absolutely vital to the way that we function.
Well, in other animals, and bonobos are a good example, we're social animals. Like bonobos, we travel in packs,
yeah,
and have traveled in packs for a long time. And it's social status is important. Being friends with everybody is important. And in bonobos, it looks like the females especially... this is a way that their homosexual behavior is a way of cementing kind of friendships and alliances with other bonobos,
yeah,
and that it's a part of their social interaction. So it can come up, that type of behavior can come up in especially in social animals, where alliances are important, friendships are important, grooming, touching.
Survivor all of a
sudden. so there's a, but something doesn't, I mean, things can persist without necessarily being advantageous genetically. They can persist just because there is so much genetic variety and variety of sexual behavior,
yeah,
out there that it can persist at a level that it's still, they say 10, between 2-10% of it, depending on how you define it.
Yeah.
So it can be out there at that level without being advantageous, but it's not as disadvantageous as people think. So when you hear these right-wing people saying, well, obviously this is a choice because it can't have evolved because they don't reproduce, well, that's just wrong. There are many ways that
yeah,
it can happen. We just don't know which one is the right one or a combination of all of them yet. So I think this idea that a gene could have an advantage in one sex but lead to homosexuality in the other sex, that's a possible factor. It might be just one of 10 things that could be going on.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we may see an answer, we may not. I also wanted to bring up Daniel Kruger's findings concerning risk-taking behavior. Now, Kruger believes that risk-taking may have given males a shot at status. There are different forms of risk-taking. There is the kind that is attractive, and then there is the kind that is unattractive. But like this question of homosexuality, well, as any episode of Jackass will show you, unattractive risk-taking is completely still in our innate behavior. Well, so is this a similar scenario here?
It might be. I have to admit, I'm not like a huge watcher of Jackass, so
I've only seen clips, and it was enough for me. But
I think there could be a holdover from a time when taking extreme physical risks was more common. Most of human existence, people lived out in nature and hunted and gathered things, and so maybe taking extreme physical risks was the main way that people did try to stand out and get attention and stand out from the crowd. So there could be a holdover that was advantageous to our ancestors. And so we still have this, especially males have this desire to stand out one way or another, finding a way to stand out from the crowd.
The gist I'm getting here is that there are a number of scientific studies into all this, but it really boils down to perception, it seems. I mean, I also want to bring up on the subject of older people having sex, you wrote a column when you were at the Philly Inquirer, and you report upon receiving an inflammatory email from a reader who objected to you writing. And you write, "What's interesting about this geriatric fetish is not that it happens, but it's considered so extraordinary." And you also suggest that menopause, which of course happens in humans much earlier than in chimpanzees, is one of the biological determinants. So, going back to this question of cultural perception versus evolutionary science, well, how does a biological determinant like this influence a cultural perception, such as in menopause?
I think that's a very good question. I mean, it's interesting. It's one that what that writer was referring to wasn't older people having sex with other older people. It was
younger people having sex with older people. Yes, yes.
And in particular, younger men having sex with older women.
Yes.
And I think I pointed out that as a society we're sort of more shocked by, you know, really like much older women and younger men than we are by, we sort of accept the idea that old guys are gonna, you know, Donald Trump is gonna end up with 20-year-olds because that's just the way it's been, and we don't have a special name for them like cougars or something. So,
yeah.
But I think some of that does come down to if men mate with women who are past their fertility, they're not going to be passing down any of their genes. And if you're a chimp, you will, because the females stay fertile for pretty much their whole lives. So you can mate with a female of any age, and sometimes the older the better, because they're the high status females who have the best territories and will have the most food to feed the babies. So for them, there's a reproductive advantage in choosing the older ones. In humans, there's a reproductive disadvantage. So it could get bred into people not to choose a mate beyond menopause. But people are complicated, and people also have a lot of pair bonding and stick together, and many, many couples, the man doesn't necessarily walk away from the woman when she hits menopause. So it may be a tendency, but it's not something where you're automatically out of the game, I hope.
Yeah. Or it's a cultural perception that originates from the ticking biological clock, perhaps.
Yeah. I mean, that there is a youth premium that you see out there, as annoying as it is.
Yeah.
You know, that men tend to lust after these really young women, and the rest of us get annoyed by it. And it's, you know, it's sort of sad that if we were in a different type of species, we wouldn't have to deal with that. It would be like we just get better as we got older. And we do in many ways get better. I think it's a tendency. It's not universal.
No.
There seems to be possibly a biological component for this incredibly annoying cultural thing. That
so being human then is about conquering and defying these biological determinants and saying, hey, older women make better lovers.
Sometimes that's a great thing
about it. Sometimes it's true, actually.
Sometimes it's true. Yeah. And so I think, people are, I mean, that's what people are so interesting, because we also are programmed to mate and to want to mate, but we invented birth control and all these great things so that we don't have to have a baby every time we have sex. And We've invented paternity testing. We've invented a lot of things to circumvent some of the factors that have influenced us for a long time. So we're kind of clever in a lot of ways. We invent ways to still enjoy our lives and get around some of these biological constraints.
Sure, sure.
At birth control is one of them. I think also kind of recognizing, sort of saying, I used to think that younger was better, but now older is okay too.
Yeah.
So we can circumvent some of those things, and also they're averages. They're talking about the average, not about everybody.
Yeah. So it's the triumph of the mind over the body, then.
Well, as I wrote in that column, there was a guy who called me who said he loved older women, and he meant older. Like, he was 28, I think, and he wanted women in their 80s. Like, he didn't mean women like Kim Cattrall. He meant Gina Lollobrigida.
Yeah.
You know, he meant like really old. And that was what I said there was, it's what's interesting is that it is extraordinary that when I heard from him, I was like, wow, but in other animals that's normal. So it was kind of, I thought it was fascinating that, first of all, that we think it's extraordinary, but also that despite whatever happens on the average, there are people out there,
It's like the much-cited rule on the internet. If there is a particular kind of fetish, a website will exist for
it. Yes, and that guy is definitely not the only. I'm sure there's a whole website devoted to his thing, and guys in their 20s that want 80-year-olds, that they're out there.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he could find friends to mend together with and go to the nursing homes and pick up.
But what do we do? Do we just fight cultural perceptions and say, hey, this is perfectly normal, you can have your 80-year-olds if you like, or you can... Who sets the limits here? Are the pundits or the scientists? I mean, it seems to me that we have a running dialogue here that the cultural commentators are as much of a force, if not more of a force, than those who lay down the hard science.
Well, I think that's always going to be, because scientists are busy doing their work, and then everything gets interpreted and sensationalized a little bit. But one point that I try to make in the book was that I think that understanding ourselves through science is still better than remaining ignorant, that we can make better judgments about what we want to do and how we want to be and what we want to define as moral and immoral based on a more complete understanding of ourselves. I don't see how it can hurt to be knowledgeable over being ignorant and to keep working at it, keep trying to gain an understanding of ourselves, and then use that as a tool to better understand where we should draw limits, what we should decide is right and wrong. There's so many rules that seem arbitrary.
Yeah.
Gay marriage, why should it be wrong? So understanding ourselves better may help us to deal with, and also deal with the other side of the debate, to deal with why do people think it's wrong? Those of us who don't think it's wrong, look at those people and think, what's going on with those people? Why do they think it's wrong? There's maybe something going on with them that we should understand better so we can figure out why we're fighting against these people that think it's wrong.
Got it. Well, Faye, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, and it was a lot of fun.
Thanks. Absolutely.
I went to your house looking for some sympathy. I held my head down. Alas, you gave me no pity. See, I had my reasons. I'm a man of principle, you see. You wouldn't believe them. You call me hopeless and lazy when there's so many things I wanna do, so many things I gotta prove and try.